You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Dark Party Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Pranusha. E wha ake nei coming up on the show, for City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about the increased demand for public transport in Auckland and the boil water notice for parts of Auckland that was lifted yesterday. And I spoke to Dylan Nightingale, CEO and founder of Veramere Charitable Trust, about an app she has built to support anti-migrant exploitation advocacy. Pranusha, what have you got for us today?
Our weekly catch-up with Labour Party news. News Director Carter spoke with MP Shannon Halpert about the government's stance on the US-Iran conflict, the Tukituki Water Security Project and Labour's public transport policy. I spoke with Dr. Kate Kersey about new research exploring how middle-aged women understand and manage their drinking. And I spoke with Associate Professor Bridget Connor about a new UNESCO report highlighting gender inequality in creative industries.
Kia ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka ue wari wari iahiana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehiri rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, mihaere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Lima Toru Iwa Lima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Over the past couple weeks, the government has been hesitant to call out the US and Israel for their role in the recent conflict in Iran. While Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has called for all parties to comply with international law, he refrained from explicitly addressing either aggressor. Only in the past week has Luxon offered any criticism, calling Trump's Iran policy unhelpful, and Finance Minister Nicola Willis alarmed at Trump's comments around the destruction of civilization in Iran. Labour has criticised the government for its lack of a hard stance. Also, this past week has seen funding for the Tukituki Water Security Project secured, which could see flooding for significant amounts of conservation land in Hawke's Bay. The project could see acceleration of the fast-track approvals bill, which Labour has also criticised since its inception. Lastly, Auckland Council has repeatedly called for additional support for public transport amidst the fuel crisis. Despite these calls, the government has yet to deliver. To discuss each of these topics and what the Labour Party could bring to the table, News Director Carter spoke to Labour MP Shannon Halpert.
We've seen Christopher Luxon talking about the US and Israel's conflict in Iran, and he's made several comments not directly making a condemnation of their approach, but rather calling it unhelpful and saying that New Zealand expects all countries to remain compliant with international law. This response has been criticised by some people as not being strong enough on the issue. What would a Labour government response to these strikes look like?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the government's strategy of appeasing Trump over the past few weeks has really failed. New Zealanders have asked for Prime Minister Luxon to really stand up to call out some of the comments from President Trump more recently. And so if you compare that with the comments from Chris Hipkins, the leadership that he has demonstrated over this, it's quite a contrast. And so it's important that the international law is upheld and that New Zealand really stands for something in the decisions in this.
And New Zealand has a strong history of standing for human rights issues and standing against human rights violations overseas. Do you think this government is living up to that legacy, and how further might this government, might a Labour government do things differently?
Well, we certainly welcome the two-week ceasefire that was announced yesterday. It's come as a significant relief to the region and around the world, I guess, and we have to just watch where to from here. Diplomacy is really important in those relationships, I think, that we've seen from a previous Labour-led government, and to some extent from Winston Peters in this instance, is incredibly important, and we can't lose sight of that with some of the more outrageous politics that have played out within this over the past couple of weeks. A Labour government, you know, moving forward will ensure that those relationships are strong, but most of all, that offshore they saw the history of New Zealand, and that we've stood up for international law, that New Zealand is in fact an independent country on our views, and that we're respected for that.
I wanted to also talk about this morning the Tukituki Water Security Project, which is looking at a dam in the Hawke's Bay that could end up flooding large portions of conservation land. This project is potentially going to see approval through the Fast Track Approvals Bill and sort of circumventing some of those environmental concerns. What's the Labour Party's view on this project specifically and on some of these projects approved under the Fast Track Approvals Bill more broadly?
Yeah, Labor was clear that we condemned the national government's fast track process because it does bypass environmental protections and takes away the acknowledgement of Te Tiriti within that decision making process. This is an example down in the Hawke's Bay. I grew up there. I know the area well, where the government really is making poor choices. They're not prioritising the things that are important. There's acknowledgement that some of the work that needed to be done post-cyclone hasn't been completed yet, but they're investing $18 million in this zombie project. So I don't think the government's got their priorities right in this instance.
And Labor's been critical of the Fast Track Approvals Bill, as you mentioned in the past. What would that criticism look like if Labor was elected into government later this year? Would there be a scrapping of the Fast Track Approvals Bill? Would things be reworked? Do we have any indication of what Labor's policy will be there?
So when we were in government, we had a process of our own adopted over the COVID period to enable the acceleration of key infrastructure projects that were important. We offered up investment for those as well. But the important thing for us, and what you know, what a Labor government will always guarantee, is those environmental protections and the honour of Te Tiriti of Waitangi. If I look at this particular project, you know, I'm sure some of my relations down in Ngāti Kahununu have a certain view on this, and their view came through in submissions as well over the Fast Track Approvals Bill, that they want to be heard. They want to participate in the decision making of such projects, and the government has railroaded that.
And then lastly, I wanted to talk about public transport. We've seen, even despite the ceasefire between the US and Iran, the government and economists all expect prices in the fuel crisis to continue for a wee while. Public transport has been touted as one of the potential ways to alleviate some of these pressures, and Auckland Council's been saying that if the government were to subsidise public transport a bit further, we could see a lot more benefits for people in Auckland. What's the Labour Party's view on subsidies for public transport and, I guess, assisting people in under the fuel crisis?
Labor did subsidise transport for people getting in and around both Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland and across New Zealand in public transport. We think it's incredibly important, and it's an opportunity to shift some of the behaviour that we need to see and address the congestion issue that our city has. So we're incredibly supportive of public transport. We want to see more people using that. But the government has to play their role in that. Between now and November, that might be too long to wait. People need some decisions made by this government. They need further support to address the rising fuel costs. They need to be able to still go to work. They need to go to university and study. And they need to get their families from A to B.
And Auckland Transport's been mentioning, as well as looking at this crisis, perhaps an opportunity for the growth of our public transport network and maybe some central government investment to ensure that it can grow further and become a system that's used by even more Aucklanders. Something that's been particularly brought up is the public transport fare revenue targets. Auckland Transport has quite a high target for the return from fares. Is this something that a Labor government would look at changing or maybe look at reducing in future?
Well, the national government reduced funding to Auckland Transport by something like $120 million when they came into office. That largely impacted the organisation's ability to invest in both public transport fares and public transport infrastructure to set us up for the future. You know, that's a shocking outcome in the modern world. It's a shocking decision from a government, and it just really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and so do we have any indication of what a future Labor government's transport policy would look like? Would we see further supports for Auckland Transport if elected in this year's election, or is that something that we'll have to wait for?
You'll certainly have to wait for that, but all indications, you know, from our past track record is that Labor does prioritise public transport. We know, particularly for Auckland, it's an important part of our future. The same for Wellington and large urban centres. This government has introduced congestion charging. That's one tool, but it doesn't make sense to do that if you don't have a high-functioning, affordable alternative for people to use, and that is public transport.
That was the Labor Party's Shannon Halpert speaking to News Director Caster about the government's stance on the US-Iran conflict, the Tuki Tuki Water Security Project and the public transport policy.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halpert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
A record number of Aucklanders are using public transport amidst rising fuel costs. The average number of users is up 10% from the same time last year. And yesterday, Watercare lifted its boil water notice for the suburbs of Hillsborough, Mount Roskill, Royal Oak and Three Kings after 2 days under the notice. The notice was due to a detection of bacteria on Monday, which a Watercare investigation found was caused by a single water quality monitoring tap. For City Councilling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics. I started by asking about what he thinks is driving the increased demand for public transport in Auckland.
Yeah, 100%. So our public transport system in Auckland is absolutely killing it. We're getting people flocking to our buses and stuff like that right now. And I think the big driver is cost, frankly. Our head of public transport at AT has come out and said, look, the cost of driving 15 kilometres in or out of the city now is double the cost of taking public transport. So people are sort of voting with their wallets. And I hope they stick around because it's a good service. So try it out, I would say, and see if it works for you.
There are suggestions that scheduled rail closures for April should be delayed given the surge in users. Is this something that the council has considered?
Yeah, there's been some brief discussions about it, but really we need to be driven by the needs of the project. So delaying things means delaying testing, which means delaying the CRL, and that can have huge flow-on effects and I'm concerned about flow-on effects around cost as well as delays. So we need to get that thing started, but that requires a lot of testing to make sure that it's okay before we open it up to the public. So, yeah, I can kind of see where people are coming from with that one, but the sort of downside to delays possibly too great.
Would this be a good opportunity to push for public transport improvements such as more frequent bus services or other accessibility measures like fare-free travel?
Yeah, look, I think now's the time to capitalise. There's an old saying in politics, right, to not waste a good crisis. Well, people are doing it really tough, and we've got an opportunity as decision makers, and this is kind of local and central government, to meet people's needs and do things differently and better, and hopefully those things can kind of continue through to the future. So you pointed out coverage of the public transport system, and I think that's a really good thing to look at. Personally, I think cost is something to look at as well, because people's cost of living you know, in the city is spiraling out of control in a lot of places. We can help with that directly by lowering people's costs of transport. You know, for example, I've got some really interesting figures here. So the national public transport revenue is about $300 million a year. That's across the whole country. 3 months of fare-free trips, this is just an example, would cost about $80 million in foregone revenue, right? Whereas the government's fuel payment that they've announced has budgeted as $93 million per quarter. So $93 million versus $80 million. I mean, we're getting a better deal, and we're helping the planet by encouraging people to commute via public transport if they can. So, you know, this is something we could be looking at. We could be looking at things like lowering the fare cap. That's something we could do. So, you know, I'd encourage central government to help us out here, and we can kind of help people in a meaningful way.
Obviously, there are these benefits that could be felt across Auckland, but are there any specific improvements to the public transport out west where you're based that you'd like to see?
Yeah, we're always looking at things like frequency, and things have improved a lot in West Auckland, to be fair, and especially along kind of the northeastern interim busway route and the kind of feeder services there. That's really great. So my first thing to particularly West Aucklanders listening, try out this new system if you can, because it is a hell of a lot better than what I remember when I was a kid, that's for sure. But yeah, things like coverage, of course, are big for us. And, you know, honestly, it's not related to the cost of living crisis necessarily, but I think a bus to Piha is something we should be looking at in the future as a city, because that will help out our tourist numbers and our economic development as a city as well. So that's just a little aside to kind of throw in the mix there. But, you know, on a general level, coverage and cost, these are the things we've got to keep focusing on, and that's not just a West Auckland issue, that's the entire city.
And I want to switch tacks now and ask about the boil water notice that was in place for parts of Auckland this week. That has now been lifted, but could you go through the cause of this issue?
Yeah, so there was a boil water notice from the 6th to the 8th, and that affected Mount Rossville, Three Kings, Royal Oak and Hillsborough. Now, I've been told that it's very unlikely that anyone's ingested bad stuff. It was an E. coli thing that was picked up in the drinking water. But the cause most likely was a water quality sample tap, so not necessarily the E. coli itself in the water. So Watercare, just out of an abundance of caution, said, look, let's chuck a boil notice out there, and just so that people are 100% safe, because we can't take any chances with this stuff, right? But the good news is, very unlikely that anyone's ingested E. coli. That's fantastic. But now the boil notice has been lifted as of the 8th of April, which is yesterday. So life's good. We carry on. And it's, I think, just like a reassurance for people that we have these systems in place that we can trigger if things go wrong.
Yeah, so it seems like it was a good test of the systems that we have in place for this kind of situation. But do you have any comments, good or bad, on the Watercare response?
I'm feeling quite positive about the Watercare response. When local councils or government choose to make these kind of big calls, there's always a question of, you know, does it go too far? Is it kind of a boy cried wolf situation? But, you know, I think, to me, this is not the case. I think it was important to put that out there, because they did detect something, even though it's now clear that it wasn't in the water. And like I said before, it's an assurance to people that we have these systems in place, because, you know, if anything goes wrong, we're going to be relying on those systems. So I'm feeling really positive and upbeat about the response, and I think it was appropriate.
And I just want to finish by asking, there's potentially some wild weather hitting Auckland this weekend. Did you have anything you wanted to quickly say on that?
Yeah, just everyone out there in Auckland, if you can just get yourself prepared just in case, because we don't know what's going to happen just yet. Keep an eye on the news. Keep an eye on Auckland Emergency Management, which have social media channels that will give you the best advice possible, the official advice. That's what we've got to rely on. And apart from that, just make sure you've got all your supplies ready, things like torches and batteries and those kind of things, just to be prepared, because we don't know what's going to happen. But making sure that you're prepared is an important step for the family.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on the increased demand for public transport in Auckland and the boil water notice for parts of Auckland that was lifted yesterday.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling the pitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
What can I get for you?
Yeah, can I grab a funky wasp?
Smooth or seedy?
Just how it comes is fine.
Love to do. Son of a bitch.
So quite a complicated... Quite a complicated drink, then.
What? Yeah, I'm gonna be 37.50, mate. Actually, just make it 37, because I like your attitude.
Cocktail Corner, 5:30 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive. Thanks to the Hollywood Avondale.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Future sounds from the underground.
The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future.
Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2027 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95 BFM. Thanks to Flying Out, flyingout.co.nz.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
A new UNESCO report looking at gender equality in creative industries across more than 100 countries has found significant discrepancies in the workforce. I spoke with Associate Professor of Communications at the University of Auckland, Bridget Connor, about what's driving these inequalities and what's at stake if they continue.
For those who may not know, what is the UNESCO report and what does it cover?
The UNESCO report is focused on something called the 2005 Convention on the Diversity of Cultural Expressions. That is a mouthful, but basically the 2005 Convention is like a binding legal instrument which UNESCO member states all around the world sign up to and have done so since 2005. And it basically requires all of the member states that have signed up to periodically report on all of the policy mechanisms that they are putting into place to support the diversity of cultural expressions of different kinds. So it looks at like how different nation states are working, like on cultural policy mechanisms, for example, how they are, you know, kind of funding and supporting cultural diversity in different ways. And the 2005 Convention is also really focused on particular things. For example, how culture supports human rights and fundamental freedoms, how it supports artistic freedom and artists being able to, you know, move across member states to practice their art and, you know, their kind of creative practice. And so my role in writing the most recent report has been to focus on one monitoring area, which is how member states are supporting, through cultural policy, gender equality. Right. So what different kinds of cultural policy mechanisms can we see that are supporting gender equality in the kind of making and the consumption of culture and creative goods and experiences?
There's this interesting tension that they found in the report where women make up a large percent of the workforce in the creative industries, but they're not reflected in any leadership or pay. What's driving that disconnect?
Yeah, this is such an interesting one. And this is an interesting moment in the report because since the convention was signed and ratified in 2005, that's 20 years ago, right? So we actually have 20 years of data that we can look at and reflect on in the most recent report. And yeah, this is a really interesting one. If you look back at previous versions of this report, this is quite a consistent finding that over time, if we look at, the kind of gender identity that of those that are making culture, that are cultural producers, creative workers, artists, that more and more identify as women over time, and obviously that's really positive. But yeah, there is still these things. Sometimes people refer to them using terms like the glass ceiling, but you really see that although there might be kind of, yeah, gender equal participation in certain areas of the cultural sectors, that you definitely don't see gender equal leadership or, you know, kind of the in governance roles of arts and cultural organisations, for example. Those are far from gender equal. Also, another area in which you don't see gender equality is like decision-making roles, the people that are hiring and firing in different kinds of cultural sectors. Why? I mean, it's really a complicated picture and there's no like clear answer. Obviously, it really depends because this report is looking globally. So there are big differences between parts of the world or different countries. But often you're seeing, the kind of, there are not policy mechanisms that are focused on gender equality. Often those are just not visible in many parts of the world. Gender equality is not considered to be a really important factor when making and setting cultural policy goals. So that's one of the recommendations of this report, that despite all the 20 years of progress, gender equality and other human rights and fundamental freedoms are not often considered to be really fundamentally important for good cultural policy making. And they should, right? And there are all kinds of mechanisms that could be put in place to kind of like, to shift those persistent barriers.
Another side of this report also mentions the increased online abuse that comes for women. How does this actually shape women's careers or participation in these creative spaces?
Something that has emerged in these reports over time, but it was really impossible not to talk about it in this most recent report. Yeah, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, you might say, well, new kinds of digital tools and, you know, kind of creative spaces or areas in which people, all kinds of creatives, could use digital tools to be more visible, to kind of circulate their work more widely, possibly monetize their work more widely if that's what they're interested in. Those digital tools might offer lots of potential benefits for creative workers. So there's potential there. However, I think, the rise of what UNESCO and others would call tech-facilitated gender-based violence is hard and impossible to ignore. And what's interesting here is the emerging evidence. Again, the evidence is patchy. It's hard to get really good data. And again, it depends where you are in the world. But the emerging findings show us that women or the creatives that identify as women are much more likely, when they are operating online, to face harassment, online abuse, trolling, all kinds of things like that, which then often means, you know, that kind of rather than the digital environment offering new kind of exciting creative avenues, it's kind of, again, shutting women out of these industries. It's kind of making them kind of invisible, pull back from doing the kind of work they could do online. I mean, there's also a whole other area, which is the abuse and the bias and the misogyny that is now being built into things like large language models, things like generative AI. Again, the evidence shows us that, you know, the kind of offline gender-based harms are kind of being replicated in these online spaces, and Gen AI is one of those. So we're seeing, you know, the structural biases that are already in the offline world being kind of re-inscribed within the digital and the online world. And again, like really, really concerning, some of the stats show this is kind of at epidemic proportions. So if we're already worried about the kind of gender-based barriers that are out there, I think that we should be really concerned about how these barriers are being replicated or made worse in online spaces.
You mentioned digital tools like AI. We often hear that these systems are created biased. What does that actually look like in practice?
And again, UNESCO has done some other work in this space, which we reference a little bit in the report, but there are some other reports that have come out quite recently in the last couple of years that have done more of a deep dive into into large language models. So again, what UNESCO is trying to do is survey and, you know, kind of build qualitative studies where they've looked at, okay, what kinds of, based on the kinds of prompts that you put into particular large language models, what kind of outputs do you get? And, you know, again, these are only a few studies, so a lot more work is needed in this space. But at least those reports show that often, based on the prompts you're putting in, if you're putting in prompts in which you are referring to, you know, kind of like gender-based roles, often what the large language model will produce are kind of quite stereotypical portrayals, right, which are often based on binary, traditional, outdated gender roles. You know, those kinds of things get replicated based on the prompts you're putting in. And, you know, again, the other thing is, you know, these stereotypes are kind of replicated based on what the large language model is being fed. But the other thing that's important to note is, you know, again, it's hard to make causal links, but if we again look at the creative workforce, right, who is involved in developing large language models, again, it's hard to get really clear stats, but the tech workforce more widely is, you know, largely dominated by white men who are working in these positions. I mean, one study I cite in the report would say that developers, 90% of them, 90 out of 100% identified as men. So if this gives us any indication about the workforce, again, I think there's a homogeneity to the tech workforce, and that is arguably having some impact in terms of what the large language models are producing, and the kinds of, yeah, worldviews and positions, you know, that are represented in that workforce. So again, you know, that it's really hard to make causal links. More research is needed, but what we can see, I think, is quite worrying in terms of, yeah, again, the bias and the misogyny that is being built into the architecture of large language models.
You've said Aotearoa isn't as visible in these global conversations as it could be. Why do you think that is?
Interesting question. I wonder about this. I obviously, you know, there are limited resources, right? Especially at the moment, there is a lot happening in the world. So I guess in terms of resources, it's not necessarily always possible for Aotearoa to be, you know, in all of these kind of global forums and part of these conversations. But I suppose, I mean, I've been traveling a fair bit for this work and this report, particularly in the last year. And yeah, I've certainly found in some of these international forums, Aotearoa is not as visible or present as we could be. And I think also there is just some work that we could do to offer more visible contribution to the conversation that is centred on this 2005 convention. Aotearoa is a signatory to the 2005 convention, so we do report, right? We report back to UNESCO on the work that we're doing. But I do think there is more work we could do there. And again, that's maybe incumbent on us as researchers who are involved in this to kind of make this a bigger part of the conversation around cultural policy making here in this country. But we are doing some really amazing work, much of it, of course, founded within Te Tiriti Te Awaitangi. I mean, there's so much we are doing in terms of cultural diversity, and I think we could just be more involved in connecting with the 2005 Convention, connecting with other nation states that are doing this work, and I think just more loudly and proudly speaking about the work that we do. Again, you know, there are issues here around, I don't think that cultural policy making is funded sufficiently in this country, and I'm not the only one, I think, that would argue that. So I think there's more advocacy work we could do to put this on the agenda, and I think that work is really important in these difficult times. So it's really just about, yeah, I think being more vocal and celebrating what we do, and then kind of, yeah, just trying to ensure we are part of this broader 2005 convention conversation.
And if we think about creative industries shaping culture, what's at stake if women aren't equally represented in these spaces?
Great question. You know, again, I think UNESCO would argue that, as I said early on, you know, within this 2005 convention, you know, human rights are human rights and fundamental freedoms are at the core of this work. And, you know, this 2005 convention very clearly maps onto the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Again, one of those goals is also relates to, you know, all kinds of policy making work we can do to support gender equality. I think the stakes are really high, and I would say particularly at the moment the stakes are high when we are clearly seeing a wider backlash globally. You know, the term equity, diversity and inclusion is, you know, by some governments seen to be now a kind of a bad word. These kind of gender equity, gender diversity programs, funding to support this work is being cut in many places. This work is being defunded in universities, in creative sectors, in broader policy making schemes. So I think the stakes are quite high. If we can see that progress has been made across the last 20 years, but I think there is a real danger, as we note in this report, that this wider culture of backlash, plus all the other the concerns raised around online harms and bias, we're at a kind of a dangerous moment where if this backlash continues to take hold, we could see more and more erosion of fundamental, you know, freedoms and human rights, which we absolutely do not want to see. So I think the stakes are very high, and, you know, we really need to be focused on this, as well as a kind of a broader landscape around how we want to ensure fundamental freedoms are not erased, alongside, you know, the erosion of democratic freedoms more widely.
That was Associate Professor Bridget Connor on gender equality in creative fields.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
VeraMe is an organisation to combat migrant exploitation in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Their new app has been designed to collect proof of underpayment of wages and other breaches. I spoke to Dylan Nightingale, the CEO and founder of VeraMe Charitable Trust, who is also a barrister in Kate Shepherd Chambers, about the app and the process from development to launch. I started by asking if she could outline the app's purpose.
Sure. VeraMe Charitable Trust. VeraMe is an acronym for Victims, Exploitation, Rights, Information and Migration. And our purpose is to stop migrant exploitation in Aotearoa by empowering workers to stand up for their rights. So the purpose of the whole platform is to give people information in different languages about their employment rights, let them know that they have got options, what a path to justice might look like, and help them collect evidence of what has been going on in their workplace. So then if they want to bring a claim, they have got the evidence to back it up.
And I'd be really interested to know, what inspired you to create the app, and how much of this came from your experience and background in legal work?
So the whole inspiration really has been from the amazing clients that I've been working with over the past 7 or so years at Community Law in Wellington and Hutt Valley. I was working there as a staff solicitor just before COVID, and we were able to get an online legal service set up really quite quickly, which was amazing and a huge testament to the people involved at the time. But through that online service, we were getting a lot of queries from people all over the country, a lot from Central Otago, for instance, where people who were on work visas were saying, you know, yeah, this is happening to me, and I'm completely stuck, and there's no support, and I don't know what to do. And before then, I had been helping people in the Wellington area, but I think really that experience through COVID made me realise just how widespread the issue actually is. And then from there, I was finding that people were really struggling to show evidence of wage theft, basically. So a typical scenario is where someone is working, say, in a hospo job, and they're working, you know, 60 to 70 hours, sometimes more than that, a week, and the employer is only paying them for about 30 or 35, and the employer has, you know, these records, maybe pay slips, that show that the worker, you know, is only working 30 or 35 hours, and then someone would come to us at Community Law and they'd be saying, well, actually, it's like this, and I'm working twice as much. And the first question is, God, that's awful, but how can you prove this? And so really the app was set up as, just as a tool, a way of helping people to get that evidence, and very much inspired from my work with clients. And I think, you know, there's probably been pretty close to 100 people now over the last 7 years and that I've worked with. And also I've done quite a lot of interviews with people for a research project that I completed at the beginning of this year. So those interviews also validated what I was seeing through the client work.
And where is the funding and support for the app coming from?
So the research component was funded by the Boren Foundation, Michael and Suzanne Boren, which is an amazing philanthropic organisation that funds legal research, social justice research across Aotearoa. But the actual tech build, so the website, the app, yeah, I had no idea building an app would be so expensive. And the quotes that we initially got would have never been able to get that amount of funding. But we were really lucky that we were put in touch with an IT developer in Wellington called SpotTech, and the founder is from Afghanistan, and he is a new resident here, and he was really, really supportive of the kaupapa. So, and did the work at a hugely discounted rate. So the funding came from, you know, first of all, we had to form the trust, and then charitable trust, and then apply for funding. And we were lucky; we got some funding from the Department of Internal Affairs, so the Ethnic Lotteries Communities, Wellington Community Trust, Foundation North. We've just recently actually completed a small project in the Bay of Plenty, and where we're trying to reach out to hort workers, and that was funded by Bay Trust. So I think the approach now that we've, the platform is up and running, we will need to keep looking for funding for maintenance and hosting, but otherwise working with specific funders in areas where we'd like to do some outreach and support in particular areas.
You've spoken to the process of creating this app, including from the clientele to funding and also the research. I'm curious to know, throughout this process, how much of the platform has changed from maybe what you were thinking at the beginning to now, if anything?
Yeah, so the concept went through a Creative HQ 13-week accelerator, which was a chance to really look at the problem from the point of view of people experiencing it, which are obviously migrant workers. But I also kind of found from that consumers really care about this problem as well. And so initially, one of the problems that we looked at and tried to design for is there a way for the public to know, you know, this restaurant, for example, they've been verified as treating their staff well, so we're happy to go there and support them. So, and that's actually where the name initially it was, you know, I was thinking maybe it could be a verification system. So an employer basically gets a stamp of approval as complying with minimum employment standards and treating their staff well, and that could be backed up by employee reviews and that sort of thing, which do exist. There are platforms like that, like Glassdoor, where employees can give reviews of their bosses. But the problem with that, and it was great having the accelerator to really test this, the problem with that is, first of all, your exploitation is so hidden. No one actually knows the true extent of this. The stats that we do have really underreport, and I think even the government acknowledges that. So, for instance, I think it was 2024, in 2024, MB received almost 4,000 complaints of migrant exploitation, which was about a fourfold increase from the previous year. But that does not give you a true picture of the scale of the problem. And then in June last year, there was a task force, a ministerial advisory group had been set up on transnational and serious organised crime. And they found that, they actually stated that you can't live in New Zealand without buying products or using services that contribute to migrant exploitation. So there is way more than 4,000 instances of wage theft, serious breaches of employment rights going on. So the problem with having an employee, I guess, not whistleblower, because this is trying to look at it as a positive, in that the problem with all of that is that employers, you know, bad employers already put so much pressure on employees. So you can just see, you know, employers will be pressuring an employee to give a fake review. You could just see how there'd just be problems with that actually being a credible way of assessing how an employer was treating staff. So there are well-known reasons for all of that, and I did look at that a little bit for the research, but it's done its own significant research into this, and none of this is So this is all really well known.
I'm so sorry to cut you off.
Yeah.
I'm running out of time. And I just wanted to ask this final question. For people who are interested in either using the app services or supporting the app, how can they do this?
So the website, verimi.org.nz, if you scroll down to the bottom of that has got a link to the app. To the app stores, so you can download the app for free. You just need to register, and it'll take you through the process. You put in your workplace, and what happens is you can just try it out. We did a the app's GPS will keep recording every time you are within like 10 metres of your registered workplace address, and it will record when you leave. It doesn't otherwise track your movements. And we did a test of this with some hospital workers in Wellington, and actually a couple of them said they had no idea they were being kind of underpaid. They were working more hours than they were being paid for. So we're confident that the app works, so just try it out. It's free, and we'd love any feedback that you've got. And then what people can do is, if they're finding that there is a problem, then they can share that in their work diary, their GPS records, with a trusted advisor. You can talk to us, and we'll connect you with a free community lawyer in your area. And we are also working with the community law centres, the 24 community law centres in the country, and supporting them to support employees.
That was Dylan Nightingale, CEO and founder of VeraMe Charitable Trust, on the app she has built to support anti-migrant exploitation advocacy. You can find more information on their website, verimi.org.nz, and if you have any suggestions for outreach, please contact Dylan through the web form.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
New research out of the University of Auckland is exploring how middle-aged women understand and manage their drinking. I spoke with Dr. Kate Kersey, a researcher in the Department of Social and Community Health at the University of Auckland, about how women navigate pressures and what that tells us about drinking culture in Aotearoa. Your research suggests that many women are actually not aware of the long-term risks like cancer and don't necessarily prioritize them in their health. What led you to explore that gap between the knowledge and the behaviour?
The woman that I interviewed actually didn't know a lot or didn't talk about cancer a lot. I didn't specifically ask them about cancer, but I asked them about the health risks associated with alcohol. So I can't really assess how much they knew about the long-term risks, but in their responses to me, they very much focused on the short-term risks, or actually I would say the health impacts of drinking alcohol, the immediate effects on their health, and very few mention longer-term risks.
Why do you think long-term risks like cancer felt less immediate or less important compared to things like immediate risks like sleep or energy or weight?
I think that there is a natural, what they call the time framing of risks, and people concentrate on what is in front of them. So these, as I call them, health impacts, you know, weight, sleep, the ability to kind of do what they want to do the next day, that's really immediate. So that's a really natural thing. But also the longer term issues with alcohol are more that they are risks, like alcohol is a risk for seven different types of cancers, including mouth, breast and bowel cancer. And there's also a perception that there are a lot of risks out there. In some other research we have done, someone actually said that, you know, everything causes cancer. You can get cancer from eating burnt toast. Now, we know that alcohol is actually a group 1 carcinogen, so it is in the same category as tobacco and asbestos. So it isn't really like that kind of burnt toast comment or crossing the road or things like that. But I think if you relegate it to a risk, it's kind of uncertain whether it actually will occur for you or not. And there's just a lot of risks that people do feel like they're managing.
Your research focuses a lot on middle-aged women and their relationship with drinking. How are women in particular navigating these social pressures differently when it comes to drinking?
So if you look historically, men have always kind of drunk in public and, you know, getting drunk and drinking a lot, it could kind of be seen as very kind of masculine behaviour. For women, drinking's always been a little bit, in the past, it was actually people frowned upon it. But when we got to the 80s and 90s, then women saw themselves as empowered and they'd go out drinking. So there's actually this relationship for women with their drinking where they just have to be really careful to find that line with kind of appropriate drinking. But at the same time, they're really encouraged to do it. We've built a whole nighttime economy with restaurants and bars that are now marketed towards women, and alcohol products are marketed to women. So it definitely very much fits in their lives. And the research that we have done shows that it has lots of meanings for women, for pleasure, for relaxation, stress management, spending time with their partners and significant others. So alcohol has a really wide range of functions in women's lives.
Do you think New Zealand's drinking culture makes it easier to downplay the risks as opposed to that social expectation?
Oh, definitely. With New Zealand's drinking culture, we very much celebrate a certain type of drinking, and alcohol is a really valuable economic activity, social and economic activity in New Zealand. The main people that we kind of focus on are those that cause acute alcohol harm, like drink driving or getting into fights, or people that can't manage their alcohol consumption. So we have a very strong idea that you can drink responsibly, and if you can drink responsibly, then you've earned the right to drink alcohol. And let's face it, we still have a very high prevalence of both drinking in general and hazardous drinking in this country. So yes, I think it's very difficult because responsible drinking is such a vague notion. And I found in my research that people could drink half a bottle or a bottle of nut a night, which is a lot for cancer, increasing cancer risk. But actually, because they're doing it all and fitting it in with their life and still being economically successful, having a great social life, still exercising, they think that's fine. So I think we actually have a very encouraging climate that's inbuilt into us, our whole social and economic web of society that encourages drinking.
You mention individual responsibility when it comes to drinking. How does that tie in with the overall health culture, like dieting, exercising, that kind of thing that happens around middle-aged women in particular?
What I found from the research was that because women are more focused on the health impacts, they tend to categorise their drinking as responsible if they can do all those other things in the health culture more. So if they're exercising regularly, tracking their sleep and making sure they get good sleep, you know, having good social networks, which is another sign of health culture, then they will worry a lot less about the amount they're drinking and regardless of the amount they're drinking. And especially if they manage to, you know, exercise and, you know, keep slim and have the outward appearance of health, then they think that their alcohol consumption is, well, I don't really know actually what they think, but what they told me is that that seems to kind of compensate for their alcohol consumption.
Your research suggests that this isn't just about individual choice. What are some of the bigger systems and environments influencing these decisions?
That's a really good question, because individual responsibility is this notion that we have in kind of our Western societies, that people should have the right to just choose what they want to do and make those decisions without having kind of regulation put on them. The problem is it can be really hard to make those decisions in societies that what we might call alcogenic. So if everything around you is pushing you towards drinking, like the availability of alcohol, and we've got the very aggressive marketing of alcohol products, particular products marketed to women that are, you know, healthy and slim and low calorie, which still often have the same amount of alcohol in them. So our environments are just not neutral. And so while women do have the choice, it can be really hard to make that choice if you're having a bad day and alcohol has that really strong meaning to you, that you should, you know, have a drink to relax. And also, for a very good example is that alcohol is available in supermarkets where women shop, and that really gives the impression it's a grocery item, and we know that it is very far from a grocery item. It's a psychoactive substance that is incredibly habit-forming and actually also addictive.
And finally, what's one key takeaway that you hope that middle-aged women around New Zealand can take from your research?
I would really, I'd like women to, well, it's a good question, because I don't just want to put all the blame on women and say, well, you need to take out from this research that, you know, you should drink less to not get cancer. But I think that if women can see that the system is a bit stacked against them in terms of encouraging them to drink, sometimes that awareness is really important to realise, actually, this isn't something that's that healthy for me. And so I want to feel empowered to do something about it. But I think the real messaging of this research is for policymakers, that they actually need to change the alcohol environments in New Zealand.
That was Dr. Kate Kersey on midlife women's health and alcohol culture.
That was The Wire.
Well,
era te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou I katoa, I kōrero mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. And thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.